Welcome today. We've got a pretty full agenda. So we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 43. So, Mr. Dawson, where are we sitting with Senate Bill 43?
Senate Bill 43 excludes certain functions performed by title companies from definition of unlawful practice of law, authorizes title companies to draft certain real estate transaction documents, while placing tangible limitations on scope of authority granted. It has a subsequent referral to judiciary. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact. And there are two, there's a dash one and dash four amendments.
Dash one and dash four. What are the dash one and dash four?
And the dash one amendments authorize the Oregon Supreme Court to adopt the rules related to out-of-state and foreign lawyers engaging in pre-litigation. And dash four amendments requires disclosure to be included in the contract, permitting opportunity to consult with legal counsel prior to transaction closure, and also delivery of that disclosure notice and copies of documents at least 3 days prior to the completion of the transaction. That's in the dash four.
Okay. Any comments from the committee on either one of these proposed amendments? Any question with them?
Yeah, I have a question. I see that, Mr. Chair, that we have a subsequent referral to judiciary.
And we were going to ask that we ask the president to suspend that and just pass it.
Okay, that's fine with me. We've worked the thing to death. So I don't know what more we could do in that committee.
Yeah, as long as the dash ones and dash fours are compatible, they run each other or something like that, I'm fine.
Is there any, would you want to give any public testimony or anything like that?
Only if you have questions.
The bar is comfortable. All right. Okay, well, we'll the chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 43. Any discussion? Any questions? So ordered. And the chair would move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 43. Any discussion? Objections? So ordered. And the chair would move Senate Bill 43. See, how am I going to do this? To the floor. Well, I guess I have to move.
As
to the
amended.
You have to deal with the referral.
Referral first. Okay. There was a subsequent referral to judiciary on this, but since we've worked this bill very hard, what I would do is move that we send it back to the president's office and that he rescind the referral to judiciary, and then refer it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Does that sound like that's fairly proper?
Yeah. Sounds good.
Proper.
If it's not proper, I think we'll find out in short order.
Okay, sounds good. So, and if the Senate President, there's a motion on the floor to send it to the President's office and rescind the referral to judiciary and with the due pass recommendation to the floor. Any objections, questions? So ordered, and I'll carry that if it is in fact referred to the floor.
There you go.
Okay, open up a work session on Senate Bill. Let's see, I better close the work session on 43 and open up a work session on 63. Mr. Dodson.
Senate Bill 63 requires Workers' Compensation Board assign multiple employer cases to an administrative law judge, authorized to manage investigation and discovery processes, cases to be set only after medical evidence fully developed, and employers and insurers with no exposure not required to participate in the trial. This is MLAC approved, and there's dash one amendment, no revenue impact, fiscal statement's been issued.
What did the fiscal statement say right now?
They'll absorb the cost.
They're going to absorb the cost?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What's that, Senator Walker? What did you think?
The fiscal indicates that the Workers' Compensation Division would absorb unforeseen costs within its budgeted resources.
You mean absorb that $221,000?
Well, that's what they say here in the comment section. The Legislative Fiscal Office would expect the WCB to seek necessary expenditure limitations from the Emergency Board to address the workload when the extent of that workload is clearly known.
Do we have any problems with that?
I guess my only question would be, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that second paragraph refers to this. mean, I almost wonder if the unforeseen costs are over and above, because they're asking for FTE for this. My only concern would be if we might be asked to send this to Ways and Means with that pistol.
Is there anybody, Mr. Chair, here from Workers' Comp?
Anybody here from...
Anybody want to pretend they're from Workers' Comp?
63. What?
To talk about the fiscal and maybe...
Fiscal impact is 63.
Clarify that.
Give us some more information here. Thank you. Please introduce yourselves. We've worked this one to death, too, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
I recognize you guys.
I have plenty of notes.
Senator Nelson, members of the committee, I'm Maureen Bach, I'm the Workers' Compensation Board Chair. We do anticipate that there will be additional workload for our ALJs. And we have currently we staff to an auditored staffing model in Hearings Division. Using that model, we have downsized our Hearings Division the last couple of biennia, so we're running fairly lean right now. And that's why we did anticipate that we would need additional workload or additional staffing to handle this workload. At this time, we do feel that we could perhaps, through limited duration positions, see how that plays out and then come back in front of the board and ask for additional limitation out of the premium assessment operating account. As you know, we are an underfunded agency, paid for by the premium assessment operating account. So that's why our fiscal is the way it is on that bill.
$221,000 is a... Fairly, you think that's a reasonable figure, but you think that you can explain to me how you think you can absorb that within the agency? Or
We do have some current vacancies right now that we're in the position of filling. Depending on the timing of filling those positions, we may be able to use that limitation.
Have you presented your budget to the...
We have. We've been through the subcommittee.
We've been through the subcommittees. Okay. Questions about this?
Will
satisfy you. Okay, I guess. Well, the least said, the better. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So we have dash ones in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 63.
Okay. Senator Walker moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 63. Any discussion? Objections? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Senate Bill 63 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 63 to the floor as amended. The due pass recommendation. Discussions? Any objections? Seeing none. So ordered. Do you actually want to carry this?
Someone's going to ask me about that fiscal, but I have the comment, so okay. I can do that.
Okay, Senator Walker would just love to carry this bill. Okay, we will skip down to Senate Bill 343 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 343.
And Senate Bill 343 merges clarification of authority with enforcement authority for persons who install and inspect water system cross connections and test backflow prevention device assemblies. Transfers certifying authority from Department of Human Services to Building Codes Division of Department of Consumer and Business Services. Dash one amendments, however, rescind that change.
Okay.
There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement has been issued.
Good. Ron and Dwayne and Dave, why don't we all come up? Ron Murray, Dwayne Carstens, and Dave McDonald. Welcome, gentlemen. Please introduce yourselves and proceed. Who wants to start here with all this? Ron, do you want to start?
No. Senator, thank you. For the record, my name is Ron Murray, and I represent the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters of the United States and Canada.
Dave McDonald, City of Portland Water Bureau, and also representing the Oregon Cross Connection Inspectors Regional Subcommittee, or the OCC IRS.
Dwayne Carstens, Clackamas River Water, and I'm the chair of the OCC IRS.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are awaiting one more amendment to Senate Bill 343. We have the original Dash 1 amendment, and there needs to be kind of a subtle change in it. Basically, what this bill is trying to do through the amendment process is the Health Division, of course, will retain responsibility for the backflow prevention program, will enable them, as they currently do, to charge a fee for the certification of testers of backflow devices. And it also allows for the Health Division to charge a fee to water purveyors on an annual basis to provide for the services that they currently provide. The fees are correct on the amendment there. As you'll see, they're very, very nominal. I believe a jurisdiction as large as the city of Portland pays $350 per year. And I'll let these gentlemen speak on behalf of the purveyors and so forth and so on. But we do believe that we have unified consensus on this bill. But my understanding is the Dash 2 amendments will be ready for your purvey.
Okay, so on the Dash 1 amendments on page 3, you're talking about the fee or your basically says not exceeding the following amounts, and the deletion is not exceeding the cost of administrating.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And when I saw the amendments, they look great to me, but the devil's in the details, so to speak, and basically those amendments kind of cross the line between charging the individual and charging the jurisdiction, and they have to be separated. The two aren't one and the same. So they kind of got blended in the amendment process there, but they're not supposed to be.
So your proposed Dash 2s, which will be coming to us eventually, do they go to the fees?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. The fee structure there will remain the same for the purveyor. But what we're just saying is the fees for the tester are one item, the fees for the purveyor are two items, or the second item, and the two shouldn't mix.
What's a purveyor?
Those are the people that deliver the water to you. We are defining that. They basically, they're ones in charge of the water from the source to the meter. And what this statute also will do is clearly define that from the outlet of the meter, the jurisdiction having control will be the plumbing authority. So,
gentlemen. Introduce yourself again, just your name.
My name is Dwayne Karsten. I work for Clackamas River Water, and I'm the current chair of the Oregon Cross Connection Patrol Regional Subcommittee. We tried to find a longer name, but we couldn't quite come up with
Cross Connections, something like that.
We would like to support the amendments of this bill. We're concerned that there's no funding mechanism without the amendments.
In the Dash 2? Dash 1s and the Dash 2s together?
Correct.
Okay.
And the one that's waiting?
Yeah, that's the Dash 2.
That's the Dash 2. Right.
And I believe you have a letter before you, at least a copy of one that was should have been mailed out to everyone and apparently wasn't, so I got copies up here. Dave actually got the copies for you. If you need signed ones, I'll be happy to sign them before I leave.
That's good.
But again, we're looking to support the amendments so that there's a funding mechanism and the cross connection control program doesn't get lost. It's from our perspective, it's a public health issue that if this program doesn't continue, it puts the public at risk. And we'd like not to see that. We're comfortable with the funding mechanism. We think it's very lenient. We would be probably willing to pay more than that if it was necessary. So the funding in itself is not an issue with us.
Okay. So your fee schedule, you think, is all right?
Mm-hmm. I think it's fine. It seems to me quite generous.
Okay. All right, sir.
I really wouldn't have anything to add to that. We wanted to support the amendments as we understood them.
And excuse me, Mr. Chair, your name, sir?
I'm Dave McDonald, City Port and Water Bureau. I'm the chair-elect for the OCC-IRS group representing the water purveyors, water utilities inspectors.
Just need to get that on the record, who's speaking. Thank you.
Okay, there's a fiscal, doesn't show much, 63,000 expenditures and 27,000, well, let's see, no, 63,000 in revenues. Oh, it's just, oh, it's an offset. Okay, I'm catching on here. All right. That doesn't seem to cause a problem. Anybody have any questions about that? Okay, so we'll wait for the amendments and we'll get this thing moved out of here. How's that sound?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much for coming down.
Thank you.
We'll close public hearing on 343 and not go into a work session and wait for those amendments to come through. And open up a public hearing on Sentinel 831. Mr. Dotson.
One moment. Mr. Chair, thank you. Some reason? Senate Bill 831 exempts a person from licensing a specialty code inspector or plan reviewer when performing inspections, reviews directly on behalf of and under contract with the state or municipality. Makes persons inspection review activities subject to Oregon tort claims. No revenue impact, no fiscal statement has been issued at this time.
Senator Walker.
My bill.
Your bill.
All right. Reeling on this one.
Yeah.
You have a host of my bills today, Mr. Chair. I don't know how that happened, but I'm a busy business and labor gal. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator for District 7. Senate Bill 831 was actually introduced at the request of the lovely young woman sitting next to me, Charles C. Kaler, and she works at the Building Department, and she actually is going to explain to you what the purpose is behind the bill, and then we'll have more questions, I'm sure.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for this opportunity. I'm Charles C. Kaler of the Building Department, LLC, 1245 Pearl Street in Eugene. My company, formerly known as Mortier Engineering, is a private firm, and we contract with many jurisdictions in the state of Oregon for code enforcement. We serve many municipalities in Oregon as agents doing the work of inspectors, plans examiners, and building officials. We fill a small market niche and allow jurisdictions that cannot afford full-time employees to retain control of their inspection program. Our jurisdictions are as far-flung as Molalla and Estacada in the north, as far east as Sisters in Bend. We also serve quite a few communities on the coast, including Tillamook County down through Newport, Lincoln City, Florence, Reedsport, Lakeside, Dune City, and most of the small jurisdictions in Lane County. The above bill, the bill that we're talking about today, was introduced to change the effect of 1999's Senate Bill 587. It affected our type of business. The original legislation was not intended to apply to us or our types of businesses. It began as a law that would speed up plans examinations for simple single-family dwellings by allowing third-party plans examiners to be hired by the builder or developer. It became something much more onerous to businesses like ours during the legislative development and then later during the rules process. We do not work as third-party providers to builders and developers. We only work with jurisdictions and partner with governments to provide services. Our employers are required to comply to the same certification, licensing, experience testing, and credential requirements as those persons directly employed by local governments. Currently, rules for the bill excluded such contract providers as agents of jurisdictions. Besides being contrary to ORS 3.265, which includes our business under the Oregon Tort Claims Act, it is potential of putting us in an adversarial position with those that we serve. Senate Bill 831 just clarifies our position as agents. I know that some of the trades object to this, but I believe we're on the same side of the table as they are. Our employees have the same certifications and licenses that are required as they would be for any jurisdiction, as well as they have to be paid at the same rate and with the same benefits. If we didn't give them decent wages, they would go work for someone else. We need to keep them, and so we employ them at market value. We've spoken to a number of legislators in our area from both sides of the aisle, and they agree that since we offer a much-needed service, that this is sensible legislation. It restores our position to what it was prior to Old Senate Bill 587, and under which we have served more than 40 jurisdictions in Oregon since 1973. We'd appreciate your support for this legislation, and thank you for your time and attention. Are there any questions?
We probably have some. Senator Mark, do you have anything more you want to?
No, I don't have anything more. This time, I have a letter from Mr. Murray, who's probably going to testify and talk about his objections to the bill. And I think Ms. Kaler might have some responses in terms of what he might have to say. So I'd like to have that opportunity for her to come back and and respond to those.
Any questions, Senator? One of the things under the summary says makes persons inspections and review subject to the Oregon Tort Claims Act. Could you explain that a little bit?
Makes us subject to, yes, it puts us under the umbrella of the Oregon Tort Claims Act.
What would be the significance from your view?
Well, it would limit awards to the same limitations that it would limit if someone were suing the city.
So
it's just a limitation.
Right. And Mr. Chair, the reason for that is because they work for the city. They work on behalf of the city as independents. Basically, they're hired.
To clarify that.
Mr. Chair, it certainly doesn't preclude us from being insured, or certainly not from being sued.
I just wanted to have some clarifications. Ron is scheduled to testify against you. Folks just want to sit there. And Ron, you want to come up and give some of your testimony? Welcome. Please introduce yourself again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ron Murray with the United Association of Plumbers and Steam Fitters, and I would be more than willing to take Senator Walker's spot up there if it was frozen. Well, she sat up there on my bill. I just thought that was fair.
You're going to have to walk over 10,000 households to do that.
On behalf of the United Association, we did have some concerns regarding the bill. One of the primary concerns is through the Billing Code Division, Plumbing Board, there has been discussion about privatizing of inspections and so forth and so on, and the qualifications that are required of private inspectors. Certainly, our organization is not against private inspections and was very involved in Senate Bill 587. And we do look at private inspection practices as a way to encourage the billing process to kind of oversee some of the hurdles that we have when we have a shortage of inspectors and so forth and so on. Our concerns are primarily, for one thing, as you discussed, the tort liability that you did discuss. We are unsure if a private inspector is an employee of a municipality or is acting as actually a private organization which has to provide its own insurance and so forth and so on, and would not fall under the umbrella policies of the municipality. As some of you are aware, I sit on the Tri-County Industry Advisory Board, and our role there is to ensure that consistent inspections occur in all of the 27 jurisdictions of the Tri-County area, that any private entity or individual is going to work with the billing officials to ensure consistent, compliant inspection practices. And, of course, this already has been addressed. We want to make sure that the cost of the inspections is compatible with that provided by local or state jurisdictions.
Questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That's why I came back up here. Thank you. I actually have two questions, Mr. Murray, because I'm not understanding your objection. On point number four in your written objection, you said, as a neutral entity without bias or prejudice, public employees are best suited to fulfill this government role. I don't understand that, because these folks, who Ms. Kaler represents, are contracted to do the work for the cities, the municipalities around the state. So are you objecting to that, with the work that they do?
Through the chair to Senator Walker, as I stated in my verbal testimony, we don't object primarily to private inspections. And in many cases where there is a shortage of inspections, or local municipalities cannot actually undertake an inspection process of their own, we are supportive of the private inspection practices. Many times, however, I think that the public building officials are looked at as to being a totally neutral party without bias. And we have seen, in fact, I believe the Building Court Division at the current time is involved with litigation with private concerns over this very issue. We were prepared to enter a bill this legislative session, for example, that would prevent private inspectors from inspecting their own work. And that is actually a problem that is currently occurring in the state of Oregon. Specifically, we have an inspector on the North Oregon coast who also happens to be a licensed plumbing contractor. And many of our members and member contractors have objected to this this practice. And if we could use this bill as a vehicle to amend that practice, I think that would be great.
I have a question, Mr. Chair, another one. Mr. Murray, on your fifth point, you state that private contractors will be allowed to work competitively while being covered by jurisdiction insurance. This allows government to be liable both civilly and criminally for the wrongful actions of private for-profit contractors. I think that Ms. Kaler might disagree with you, and I would say that I don't see anyone here from the cities or counties to object to this bill, and I'm not quite sure you're dead on right on that. So I guess I'm not arguing with you. I guess maybe I'd like Ms. Kaler to respond to that.
Mr. Chair, through to Senator Walker. We have no intention to, we are fully insured with both errors and omissions and liability insurance. Our contractual agreements with the cities make very clear the line of responsibility. As we have been involved recently with the suit, being either an agent or not doesn't preclude the ability to be sued either by the city can be named in the suit, as can we. So I don't think this would change any of that. I don't think we have the ability to do that, rescind the Constitution. And we may or may not be covered by the jurisdiction's insurance as well. That depends on the contractual agreement between us and the jurisdiction. I know that Mr. Mortier, my predecessor, might have led people to believe that that was our intent, but that is not what this bill is concerned. It doesn't concern liability or insurability. It really merely makes us agents of the city. The licensing that we referred to here began as third-party licenses. Part of what Mr. Murray is talking about, we certainly agree with. Conflicts of interest are very disturbing, and we would not. We help to avoid that by being a neutral third party in sometimes these small jurisdictions that everybody knows everybody, and the plumbing inspector inspecting his own work is a dangerous thing for a city. And so it makes sense that they would be able to have the use of an organization like ours. If I could go further and answer to Mr. Murray, in terms of consistency and the quality, we are an organization that have been in business for 30 years. We have employees, while we're still a fairly small business, we have a number of employees that represent hundreds of years of experience in both the trades and the code business. When a small jurisdiction hires us, they don't just hire one inspector. They get the benefit of all of our years of inspection and service to all these jurisdictions in Oregon. I myself am on the OBOA Legislative Committee, Oregon Building Association, Officials Association Legislative Committee. One of our technical managers is also on the board of the OBOA. We, our plumbing manager attends code consistency classes in Tri-County. We're able to do, because we're larger, we're able to send our inspectors and our staff to these organizational meetings when normally a small jurisdiction wouldn't have the flexibility and the staff to do that. If you've only got one inspector, you can't send him or her to these meetings and to learn this kind of stuff. So we bring a great deal of expertise and a broader scope of experience than they could hope to get with their own employee. So we feel we do fill a need for them at a very high level of quality and consistency.
Questions?
I just want to clarify this, Ms. Taylor. Are you saying prior to the passage of Senate Bill 587 that your inspectors were able to do all the things that this bill would restore?
That's right.
And because Mr. Murray has brought up a couple of points here, and I was curious, and Mr. Murray is, other than the issue that you pointed out of the conflict of someone inspecting their own work, do you know if there has been any substantial problems prior to 1999 when we passed 587 with jurisdictions hiring people who weren't qualified? And I just kind of wondered how that, if we had a problem prior to 99, that since we're restoring pre-99, you know, work here.
Through the chair to Senator Metzger, I am not. I know that jurisdictions have a policy. For example, the city of Portland currently has started the application process for licensed plumbers for plumbing inspectors, and they're very firm in the qualifications. Number one being that you are a licensed plumber in the state of Oregon. And if the panel believes that this has been addressed in this bill, I'm certainly satisfied. But I'm certainly willing to have it amended that you can't inspect your own work. I think that'd be great.
Oh, I think that's that'd be very favorably received.
Is there anybody from the Building Codes Division out here? I didn't know nobody was signed up. I think we should have some insight from them also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm agreeable to such an amendment that would not allow someone to inspect their own work, and I don't think Ms. Kaler is opposed to that either.
Why don't we get you two folks together and get the building codes people here together and see if we can't work something out and see where we're at? Does that sound?
That sounds like a plan to me.
Sounds like a plan. Okay, we're going to have all these bills coming with all these amendments. We're going to have one day of amendments, so we'll be in great shape.
Okay.
Any further comments that either would you like to make?
No. We're fine. Thank you very much for your attention. I hope this works well.
Coming up and your testimony and. Let's get together here and see if we can't work something out here so we can address everybody's concerns and see what we can do.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, so we will close public hearing. That was 8:31. And open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 515. Mr. Doss.
Senate Bill 515 modifies requirements for seller's disclosure or disclaimer related to sale of residential real property. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. All right. I want to have Jana and Matt and Steve all come up. Good afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jana Jarvis. I represent the Oregon Association of Realtors. I have with me today Matt Farmer, to my left, who's our Associate General Counsel, and Steve Lucas, who's one of our members. Both Matt and Steve were involved in what you see before you today. The seller's property disclosure disclaimer came out of the 1993 legislature. We've had 10 years to work with it. It was time for some changes, some improvements, and that's what Senate Bill 515 is. So with that, I'll turn it over to Matt, and then if you have some questions at the end, happy to answer them.
Matt, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Matt Farmer, I'm Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. Just to give you a little history on seller's disclosure disclaimer, this is part of a movement that began across the United States in the late 80s. The idea was in a residential transaction, misunderstandings could be avoided if the seller would simply tell the buyer something of what they know about the property that's being sold, particularly its condition and its title. The idea was avoiding misunderstandings through the transmission of information. It was not intended to be legalistic. It was not intended to be warranties or guarantees of any kind. It is not a home inspection provision. It is simply ordinary residential homeowners telling the buyer something of what they know about the property. The bill was initially championed by realtors with this idea of creating more information in residential transactions. Realtors, as you may know, represent both buyers and sellers, and so the attempt then, as now, was to find some way to balance this information need between buyers and sellers. So the purpose of the original bill, and the purpose remains, to provide this information to ordinary buyers and sellers. That's why it applies only to residential transactions. Over the 10 years now that we've had to work with seller's property disclosure and disclaimer in its present form, we've found that there's some problems, and Steve Lucas will speak to some of those from his practice in real estate. And Senate Bill 515 is an attempt to make this law more workable and more consumer-friendly. So it does things like, first of all, it is now just a disclosure bill. The disclaimer was sort of a halfway house for frightened lawyers who felt that providing the buyer in a transaction any information was inviting a lawsuit, whereas its purpose was to simply share information rather than to make warranties. So Senate Bill 515 is an attempt to back up and say, yes, this is about disclosing information to consumers, and does away with the disclosure provisions. There's also some things that need to be straightened out about, well, whose representations are they and what do they actually know? So you'll see in the new bill that sellers have an opportunity to say they don't know, which may actually be the case. And, of course, some people think, well, everybody will just check all unknowns. The problem with that, of course, is if you're making a disclosure and you do know and you say you don't know, there's an ugly word for that. It's called fraud. And so we don't believe that that's going to be a significant problem. Because people can now say what they do or don't know about the condition of the property, we feel the exclusion for people that have never occupied the building is no longer useful, and so you'll see that that's deleted. The idea being, take for example, a landlord who has several houses that they maintain themselves and rent out and then sell one to somebody who wants to live there with their family. That person knows more about the condition of that property and its title than probably most typical homeowners, and it hardly seems fair to then give them some kind of an exclusion. Finally, you'll probably see that there's been some confusion over the years about who exactly is making these representations in a disclosure. It is the seller. It has always been the seller. They are not the representations of the seller's agents or any of the other agents, and that's the way the law is right now. However, because the agents end up signing the disclosure, and it is not expressed, lawyers have attempted to stick real estate licensees with knowledge of the seller's representations, and that is not the case now. It's a misuse of the form. An agent is responsible for their own representations. They are actually held to a higher standard than sellers are. If an agent knows of something that's wrong with the property, they have a separate statutory duty to disclose that information, whether the seller does or not. And so what we're trying to say is that the seller is responsible for the information they provide. The agent is not responsible for that, but they are responsible for their own actions. So, for instance, if the seller lies and the agent knows of it, the agent may be liable, but not because the seller lied, but because they themselves did not disclose that. In other words, their own misrepresentation by omission. That's something that is lost sometimes deliberately on trial lawyers, and this just sort of straightens that out. Finally, the bill is tries to make the disclosure itself easier to read. You'll see that the statements are now declarative sentences instead of the did you know or are you awares. Some of the issues have been updated, and Steve can speak to those. And finally, the idea is that we're trying to keep the seller's disclosure balanced so sellers will actually use it, and the responsibilities between seller and buyer remain balanced. The seller must disclose what they know, but they don't have to go out and find things, dig things up, or do inspections or so on. What the idea is to give the buyer the information that the seller actually knows, which puts them on notice to then do their own due diligence. And I think you'll see sometimes people confuse that aspect of what a seller's disclosure is about. Remember, we're dealing here with just ordinary sellers. Homeowners association issue is an example where some people don't like homeowners association. They'd like to see a lot more disclosure, but really the balance is you tell the buyer if this is an issue, and then they do their own due diligence. Otherwise, the disclosure becomes difficult to use. People tend not to use it, and the purpose of the statute to provide information to avoid misunderstanding is defeated. So that's my comments on the what this statute or what this law is about.
Good afternoon, Chairman Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lucas. I chaired the task force, the Seller's Disclosure Task Force of the Oregon Association of Realtors. I'm also a principal broker with Oregon Realty Company. I'd like to point out that this task force was made up of brokers, principal brokers, and attorneys that deal with real estate issues on a daily basis. So there was a lot of input for this bill, and these people were from around the state. So oftentimes we find the things we do in the metro area not the same way they do them in Medford, so that allowed for a broader use of this form. A lot of the things that Matt already mentioned, it's a disclosure-only bill. We had to expand from yes, no to unknown and non-applicable because, as the practitioners found out in many cases, that was the situation. We found that every homeowner hadn't been under his house or in his attic space since he'd been living in the property and really didn't know. It was not designed to make a home inspection report out of this, but again, to put people on notice. In many cases, brokers, as a matter of informational and risk reduction procedures, came up with their own forms to address issues that weren't addressed by the current statute that we have. We think Senate Bill 515 addresses many of those issues. Some of those were new laws that have come out in the past 8 or 10 years since this bill was passed originally. we have some situations with smoke detectors now. We have situations with wood stoves and wood inserts. Homeowners associations and condominium associations. This form goes in concert with the earnest money agreement currently being used in most cases throughout the state. Along with that, we expanded most of the categories, and in several cases we created some new categories. There's some other issues coming up. We have issues surrounding water intrusion, moisture, mold. So we tried to, again, encompass those issues, but enough so that a buyer that would be concerned about that would be put on notice that he may need to do some additional investigation, that this was not going to be an end-all disclosure. The issue about the real estate licensee, there was confusion that these disclosures were the licensee's disclosures when clearly they weren't. But in many situations, it took a lot of time and money to prove that. So this will eliminate the need to have to do that in the future. We feel, i.e. those of us that were on the task force feel, we put together a very good bill to accomplish what the original intent was, to put people on notice about the situations concerning a piece of real property that the bill addresses when they go to purchase it.
Mr. Chair, I do have one other comment, and that is this is a fairly lengthy bill, and while we were looking at it at the end of last week, we did notice a couple of drafting errors, so we are asking for some amendments on that as well.
So with this new form that you're proposing, you have yes, no, unknown, or not applicable. Is that correct?
Yes.
So if you put in unknown, that shifts the burden then to... Does automatic shift the burden then to the buyer, or how does that work?
Chairman Nelson, there's really no burden here. What this is information from one individual to another, and we tend to look at it far too legalistically. There's no burden here. The seller is telling the buyer in response to a particular question, I don't know the answer. In that sense, the buyer, if they are then concerned about that issue, would have to investigate it, but then that was the buyer's burden, not because of the law or anything, just because obviously, in a person who is buying something as important as a house would already have decided that they needed to invest some investigation into it.
The buyer, I guess, at that point could say, well, I'm not going to buy this house until you give me some more information.
Chairman Nelson, that's a good point. Again, here the purpose is that the seller provide this information. If the buyer's unsatisfied with that because it's too incomplete or whatever, then their option is to find another property. That's right.
Yes, I'm not sure when you're going to answer this, but I thought it was very interesting what you said about the fraud aspect of the seller, if they knowingly were aware that they had a oil tank in the back and they said unknown, and you could prove that they had called remedial people and whatever and definitely knew that, but that the agent would not be liable for that. That would be that any fraud case would be made against the seller, if you could definitely show their question was wrong. My question would just as we have lots of real estate agents and they own homes, I'm just curious, what would happen if you had a real estate agent selling their own home? I'm with Barbara Sue Seal Properties and I'm selling my home and I do my seller representation and I am misrepresenting it. Do I also then make my firm, because I'm also an agent and I'm not supposed to do that, does that also then provide liability to that particular company now?
When agents sell their own homes, then typically they're acting as a seller, and in many cases they're held to higher standards than the everyday seller would be. And so in the situation you described, if they did say unknown when they truly knew or something like that, then in most cases, at least from my perspective, they would be treated as any ordinary seller in that situation.
So, but you say that their company would not bear any liability that if the deep pockets deal, they were also an agent and they didn't perform obviously as an agent, because as the owner, if we prove fraud as an owner, we prove fraud as the agent. I don't know, I just like that's an interesting conundrum there.
Well, Chair Nelson and Senator Metzger, it's probably a legal question, more so than myself as a real estate broker, and no doubt some attorney would try that.
if I might, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, yeah, that's exactly it. The situation is not different if the agent is selling their own home than when they are representing any client, and that is that the firm is liable for its own errors and omissions. So that if it has reason to know that this agent who's selling their own house has made some false statement, then that's their liability. But the misstatement itself of the sellers is not theirs. It isn't under the law now, and this change just makes that more clear, that division between who's responsible for what. Seller's responsible for the lie. The agent could be responsible if they know and cover it up.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know which of you wants to answer this question, but the chair asked, we're just checking off yes, no, yes, no. That part of the form isn't changing, is that correct? It's always been a yes, no sort of form.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, yes, it has. The only change is that now the sentences are declarative, whereas before they were all hedged by are you aware or do you know? And so the ambiguity was built right into the question. Now the question is declarative. Do you know, yes or no, or unknown?
Okay. Okay, Mr. Chairman, sure. I continue. Then you know what's coming next for me, because you've been in to visit me in my office, and I have constituents here today who are going to testify on two bills that I have up after this, and we're going to talk mold for a few minutes. And as you know, that's an issue that's made national attention in the last 10 years as people have discovered this problem with toxic mold, whether it can be described as toxic or not. I think you all can define mold. If the issue gets down to defining whether it's toxic mold. Would that be correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Walker, yeah, that's right. We are very aware of the rise in litigation around the issue of mold. A tremendous amount of uncertainty over that that issue. In our bill, we've tried to handle it in two ways. One is to strengthen the disclosures regarding water intrusion, which I think you may know is really the basis of mold. It's necessary condition to the growth of mold, whatever that kind of mold, and to ask if there has been these issues, have there been claims made, have they been remediated, and so on. That's a new provision in our version.
And if I could
and also we asked.
Can I interrupt you, though?
Oh, sure.
I just want to make sure that the committee's aware of where that is in the bill, and I have it in front of me. It is on page 14, line 24, section 2E. Are there any water source plumbing problems or needed repairs? Is that what you're referring to, Mr.
Actually, on 15, line 36F, which you'll notice has an asterisk by it,
mm-hmm.
Which requires further information if it's available, asks, are there any moisture problems, areas of water penetration, mildew odors, or other moisture conditions? And if yes, explain the frequency, extent of the problem, insurance claims, repairs, or remediation. And that's a way to get at these bigger issues around mold. There is another common reference just to mold later in the disclosure. And, of course, there you would say, in the shower, if we don't...
17.
Yeah, in the shower, 1730. In that case, you could say anything from, yes, we've had this terrible problem, to, well, if the fan doesn't, you don't turn the fan on in the shower, you might have to use some, you know, shower spray. It just asks what information do you have. And mold runs the whole gamut from a very, very serious health problem to the sorts of things that is in every home and every building and right here around us.
Okay. That, and that's my question, if I might follow up, Mr. Farmer, because in Section F, on line 30, you just simply state the word mold. And I would think every homeowner in the state would have to check that, because we all have mold in our shower and, from time to time, and that's why we buy X14 and spray it down and get rid of it. I mean, how wide, how broad, how narrow are we going with your mold disclaimer?
Yeah. Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, yes, that's a problem. Here that is placed in that context because it involves substances that are environmental hazards. And so you have to look at it in the context that it is asked for. I don't believe that that would cover shower mold. There may be people who, in caution, would want to mention that. It allows the homeowner to provide information regarding their experience with this, whereas the real issue is the claims and moisture penetration and so on that may be part of a much larger problem.
And then I guess I would like to follow that up with in my bill, Senate Bill 557, that would modify the disclosure statement. I have on page 9 in Section J asked the question, has anyone experienced long-term respiratory problems, headaches, fatigue, weakness, memory problems, unusual bleeding, or other symptoms while residing on the property? And we've had the discussion, at least Ms. Jarvis and I have in my office, that that is a subjective health concern for you that you just don't feel should be in the disclosure statement, and I tend to think it might really define what we mean by mold here. So could you maybe comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, as an attorney, let me comment as an attorney first of all. The seller's property disclosure is just that. It asks about the condition of the property and its title. It does not ask, and I think it is dangerous legally to start asking about the health of the inhabitants. As soon as you start asking about the health of inhabitants to property, you have, in what you just read, described AIDS, Alzheimer's disease, and other issues that may raise very serious anti-discrimination issues about what can and can't be disclosed about a person's health. And so I understand the concern. I just don't think you can reach it by asking directly about the inhabitant's health, because it's too broad a category. Really what you're talking about is symptoms, not even particular diseases, but just general symptoms. And I just would be very concerned about the liability that would attach to something like that. There are both state and federal laws that speak to those types of issues about disclosure of health-related problems.
I wasn't aware of those, Mr. Farmer. Are you telling me that there are state and federal laws that if you don't disclose health issues when you sell your home?
I misspoke, Senator Walker.
Okay.
There are both state and federal laws that prohibit the disclosure of such information.
Oh, prohibit the disclosure of health information?
Yes. Many of them.
These are civil rights.
Civil rights, in the case of AIDS, specific state prohibitions in real estate against such disclosures.
Okay. That makes
Do you need some sites? Can you give me some?
I don't have the site right in front of me. I think probably when your bill is up, there will be people that will.
Okay.
But there is both the federal anti-discrimination thing and there's specific provision in Oregon state law that prohibits the disclosure of such information in a real estate transaction. One of the places that I'm aware of as a real estate attorney is in Section 93275. That information is made not material to a real estate transaction. And then also under the anti-discrimination laws, which I don't work with but have seen, there is a specific prohibition against the disclosure of such information.
All right, thank you. Those are my questions, and I appreciate your responsiveness.
I just have one more just to consolidate since we are moving to 557. Do you have any objection to Senator Walker's other item in the same form that she has in her bill, which is having being tested or treated for asbestos, formaldehyde, or radon gas, lead-based paint, mold, or fuel? I'll ask you that while you're here now.
Oh, I don't have that in front of me.
It would follow in your bill on 17, page 17.
How long you might
follow? It would follow F. That was the other issue that she had in this form.
This one.
And Mr. Chair, I want to thank Senator Metzger for asking the question I mentioned.
Yeah.
Chair Nelson, Senator Metzger, no, this is very similarly worded to what we had. In fact, when we looked at Senator Walker's bill, our focus was kind of on item J on page 9 because of the health-related issues. When she references that item G, is pretty much follows the pattern of what we had included in our page 17. Is that section J, if I remember correctly?
If I might.
Yes,
if I might. Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, just glancing at this, I think that's probably a better approach than the existing item F on page 17. It makes it more clear what is being discussed. Item F asks if there are any of these things. Your provision asks if you've been subject, has been tested for that. It's a much more precise question, more easily answered. So perhaps a substitution might be, because the language is almost identical, a substitution might be the easiest way, and I'm sure we'd be happy to explore that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that, and because as I told Ms. Jarvis in my office, I'd just soon roll with 515 if we can make some adjustments, and I think that is a very good point, and I want to thank Senator Metzger for bringing it up.
What's the practical effect of, say, the seller puts down unknown on any one of these things? And then, in fact, say asbestos does show up. What happens at that point?
Chairman Nelson, what happens is the same thing that happens with any claim that something has been misrepresented here. Basically, the same thing that would happen is if they had said no. But it turned out later there was a case, then you have to make the connection. You basically have to show that the statement was false at the time it was made. And so it's just a variation on that.
And then another part of the bill is there's all these, there's been said there's considerable confusion about the 5-day revocation period. This bill changes all those things. Kind of explain that to us, would you, if you can?
Yeah, Senator Nelson, originally, and there's been tremendous confusion over this particular issue, causing great stress to both buyers and sellers, and that is that in its present state, the seller can elect to either disclose, which involves filling out the disclosure form as it now exists and delivering it to the buyer, in which case then the buyer has 5 business days in which to revoke their offer. Or they can elect to disclose and say, to disclaim, you're purchasing this property basically as is, and in which case the buyer then has 7 days. And so basically the disclaimer says, I'm not providing you any information and you have 2 more days to decide what you want to do. Lawyers have long advised sellers not to disclose. To a lawyer, it's a no-brainer. You get if you fill out this big long form, in which case you may or may not be liable for having correctly represented these things, or you just say, I'm not telling you anything, and the only penalty is that the buyer has 2 more days to walk away. So you had real estate licensees who tend to favor disclosure because it avoids misunderstandings, encouraging people to disclose the condition of the property, attorneys claiming that such disclosures shouldn't ever be done, and recommending disclaimer. Well, it doesn't take too long to see that at some point, if disclaimer becomes the market choice, the whole idea behind disclosure has disappeared because everyone will just start to disclaim. We're seeing that pattern. And one of the problems, of course, is, and a big problem with this whole thing, is realizing that this is not, as Steve put it, a inspection form. This is information provided by an ordinary person who is selling their house about what they do and don't know about that house to an ordinary buyer. In that context, it makes sense when you start getting into these statutory as-is clauses and so on. It made it more legalistic. For instance, the statutory form says you're buying this property as-is with all defects, if any. Sellers would read that to believe that, oh, I know the basement floods, but if I disclaim, I don't have to say anything. Well, that's not the law, you know, and therefore it sets them up for claims and just created a tremendous amount of confusion. So it was a confusing provision that tended to defeat the purpose of the bill, and that's why we're recommending that it be taken away. At this point, the seller's choice is very simple. If they don't want to say anything about the condition of the property, the buyer has until the closing to revoke their offer. If they want to disclose what they know, then the buyer has 5 days from delivery to decide to do it.
It seems like it still creates a burden of proof along someplace along the line, but I don't know.
Senator Nelson, yes, it does. That's right. And we try to keep it at the level of information among honest people. And when that doesn't happen, then those issues arise.
Usually happens.
Ordinary course of business. Further questions here? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Steve, you want to say anything else? You're happy with everything?
Chairman Nelson, yes, I mean, I could just tag on a little bit about, you know, dealing with the everyday homeowner. And you mentioned about the unknown. In many cases, the choice of yes and no, owners were just leaving them blank because they said, I don't know. And so, you know, that was in violation of the form to begin with. The other thing about the disclaimer, as Matt pointed out, was many sellers did not read the form, and so they just thought, if I disclaim, I'm okay, when in fact they were supposed to note any known defects. But for some reason, they didn't read that line. And so we ended up in situations where they disclaimed, but there were still problems with the property, and it just created a lot of confusion. And again, that, you know, this is just what the person that lives there knows about the property. As I pointed out before, many of these people haven't climbed up in their attic space. They haven't climbed in the crawl space under their house or anything else. They just literally don't know. And that's why we have professional home inspectors now, so that they can do that. And it may feel like the burden is on the buyer, but after all, the buyer is the one purchasing the product, if you will. And they certainly want to be sure in their own minds that it's a product worth purchasing. Thank you.
Thank you. Harriet Heisey. Yeah, wait a second. We better recess the public hearing for a second as Senator Metzger just did step out and open up subcommittee 5:15. Welcome, Harriet.
Thank you very much.
Please introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Harriet Heisey. I'm from Bend, Oregon. And good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I want to thank you for allowing this time for public comment on SB 515. It is not the entire bill that I wish to comment upon, but only Section 7, Common Interest. It's at the begins at the bottom of page 16. And as one who lives in a common interest development controlled by a homeowners association, I believe that the questions in Section 7 are too few and too vague to give a home buyer adequate information as to what they are buying into. Homeownership in a common interest housing carries with it a level of property control and financial obligations many people do not understand. You'll have to excuse me, I have a cold, so if I... The developments are often private communities enhanced with amenities, and they require assessments in order to maintain them. Homeowners associations have power to adopt and enforce rules, regulations, covenants, conditions, and restrictions upon homeowners as to the use and occupancy of that home. And if they conflict with the power that is far-reaching financial, financial consequences may result. The associations are empowered to impose liens and collect the assessments, fine fees, and late charges, and to foreclose upon a homeowner's property when such charges are left unpaid. An entity with that kind of power should be questioned, and the buyer should receive answers. Even then, one cannot be fully prepared for the problems that may ensue. I have attached a copy of the questions that I believe critical. They are on the back of my comment sheet, and that a buyer have answered before they ever deposit the earnest money. The choice of the use of the answer unknown leads me to ask for the inclusion of a statement informing a buyer how they can obtain additional information about the association and its operation. At the bottom of the proposed questions, J gives the prospective, allows the prospective buyer to, upon written request of an owner, association may make available for examination and duplication reasonable hours, association documents, and information. That's in the ORS statutes 94670 and ORS 100480. I think that's something that should be in the disclosure statement so that a buyer is aware that they do have that right to ask for additional information and that the seller has to go to the homeowners association to obtain it for them if they request it. The other one is item K, which is on the back of that, and that tells the prospective purchaser to carefully review all governing documents recorded and unrecorded. That is important, the recorded and unrecorded statement. The documents contain important provisions relating to maintenance obligations, restrictions, and requirements of a property owner. They also provide for the right of the association or other governing entity to adopt and enforce the rules of conduct relating to the residential use and obligates the homeowner to pay assessments to the association, and that the amount of the association assessments may be changed. This gives the buyer the notice that they need to read those documents when they receive them. Just as the comprehensive advisory in the bill advises the buyer to hire a qualified specialist to inspect the structural integrity of the house, I think the bill should also advise the buyer to inspect the provisos that govern the use and occupancy of the property. When I refer to item C, the governing documents ask the question, are the documents recorded or unrecorded? This is very important because the CC&Rs are recorded, but the bylaws are not. And oftentimes there can be one rule in the CC&R that is the same in some ways but reads differently in the bylaws. And I'll give you an example from my own homeowners association rules and CCNRs.
What's CCNR again, Jesse?
Codes, covenants, and restrictions. And those are recorded. It says in here, suspension of members' rights. This is in the CCNRs that is recorded. It gives the right of the association to suspend the right of an owner or an occupant to use any of the facilities during a time that an assessment is not paid. That suspends his right to use the swimming pool or the golf course or whatever. The bylaws then say that it suspends the voting right and the right to use the recreational facilities. So you can see, sir, you have a difference there. And when the buyer receives this document from the title company, the recorded one, it only will say that he would have his rights to use the recreational facilities suspended. But when he actually is in the house and he receives the bylaws from the association, it would say he not only has his recreational rights suspended, but his voting rights as well. So that's why the stipulation that recorded between recorded documents and unrecorded documents be furnished at the same time when the disclosure statement is completed. I think it's important that they receive those when they are looking at the property. When the disclosure statement is completed by the seller, those documents should be available then for anyone who, at the time they sign the earnest money receipt, those documents should be there. So they know exactly what they're buying and not wait for a preliminary title report to come. The answers to the questions regarding age restrictions, pets, parking, or rental or leasing of the unit, these are also questions that should be in the disclosure statement because those items are items that are frequent for disputes. Someone will say, well, I didn't see it in the CCNRs, or I didn't see it in the bylaws. And so I've moved in, and now I have a dog I have to get rid of. So that is important, I think, that those questions are asked at the time of disclosure, so that when someone looks at the property, they will have that answer before they ever move any further with it. About the assessments, the bill simply asks the question, are there any pending or proposed special assessments? And I believe a more accurate question would be, are there any special assessments affecting your property? If the answer is yes, then a reasonable follow-up question would be, has the special assessment been imposed? What is the total amount? How it is assessed? And what is the purpose of the assessment? And then ask if the assessment has been approved and not yet imposed, what is the total amount and the estimated date that it would be imposed. Asking the seller if they are aware of any future assessments under discussion by the association in open meetings also expands information about a potential financial liability and signals the buyer to ask further questions from the association. Special assessments can run into thousands of dollars and seriously impact a family's budget. A family barely qualifying for the property and after moving in discovers special assessments upcoming of several thousand dollars may soon find themselves unable to afford that home. Any question regarding special assessments is important. And if the seller cannot provide the answers, then investigation by the buyer should follow. Here again, we're back to the questions that they should ask. Ask the seller to get the information from the homeowners association, and then when they get the documents, to carefully read them. Those two things, I believe, are very, very important to be put in the seller's disclosure statement. The questions, items H and J, concern problems that affect the financial health of the association. Is there any pending litigation? Are there any judgments against the association? I can tell you that in my own association, there's probably going to be a tremendous lawsuit because the developer has closed the golf course. He has given no reason. He closed it last summer, and there is no indication that he intends to open it this year. He will give no answers. Questions to the board, for bring up no responses. So I believe that the homeowners will probably have to take some kind of action of a lawsuit against him. Now, when I bought that property 5 years ago, would it have ever crossed my mind to say, is the developer going to close this golf course? No, never. So that's not a question I'm saying should be in here, but what I'm saying is this, living in these developments bring up all sorts of things all the time that one cannot anticipate. Therefore, I think to ask the question, are they in litigation? Are there pending judgments? Things like that. I think those are really valid questions that a buyer should be aware of and should, if they can't get an answer, then they can go to the courthouse and find out the information. All across the country, there are major problems with common interest developments. And states are going to their legislators all the time asking for legislation to correct, to improve, to rein in, to overhaul the CID statutes. And one of the major complaints is that property resale disclosure statements not only lack pertinent information, but when information is provided too late. And I believe right now you folks have an opportunity at this time to make a major contribution to home buyers by including these questions in this disclosure statement. Thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Is there a specific definition of common interest development? Or?
Well, they just call them common interest developments. Some are planned communities with single-family homes, which is the type that I live in. Others are mixed use. They'll have multiple family dwellings, single-family. Others are straight condominium complexes. It just depends. A developer can put together any combination that he wants, and they call them common interest developments.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Heise, you've been to the legislature before.
Yes, I have.
You've been here while I've been a legislator.
last session, on the same issue, only not disclosure, right. But on in common interest
well,
development.
I appreciate your advocacy, and I think you raised some really good points. My husband and I just bought a condominium, and we asked for all of those things that you just asked about.
Mm-hmm.
And we just asked for them. They went on the
You had to ask for them, though, didn't you?
Right, but it was something that I thought that we needed to know. And so I think some of your points are well taken, and I'd like you to work with, at the chair's approval, to work with the proponents of the bill to maybe address some of the concerns that you have.
Thank you, Senator Walker. I'd be happy to.
Yeah, I was seem to be the only one who have a copy of your letter.
Yeah, I got a copy.
Did you going to get a copy?
Well, I don't seem to have it, but my area
I,
kind of...
I brought statement.
I would take another copy because I don't seem to have one. Or if I do, it
here.
Got mixed up in five...
I brought 25 copies of this because I was told to.
All right, thanks.
So no wonder you folks were confused. I'm sorry.
Well, that's very good. Thank you. Jana or Matt, somebody want to come up and respond to any of this? Or Steve? Or, I don't know. Whoever, here comes Matt.
Okay.
Just introduce yourself for the record again.
Chairman Nelson, members of the committee, Matt Farmer, Associate General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are working with Homeowners Association representatives to put a few additional provisions in the seller's disclosure. As you know, it contains right now a provision regarding common interests. And again, in keeping with our previous testimony, this is where ordinary people who are selling property tell the buyer something of what they personally know about it. Most of what I've heard here is really what homeowners associations, as homeowners associations, should know or tell or disclose. Often I think the sellers have some of the same concerns expressed here. I don't think it's practical to shift to the seller the homeowner association's burden. They may or may not know these things. And again, the idea is to make the disclosure for the seller seller a simple thing so that they will do it, to give the buyer notice so that they can then investigate. If some other disclosure from homeowners associations or other community groups is necessary, that's a separate issue. This bill speaks to what an ordinary seller would know about their homeowners association. They may not like the homeowner association any better than anyone else, but that's not really the issue. They need to say, yes, we have one. Here's some things I know about it because they've told me. And, of course, if you want more information, you should go get it, much as I guess you did, Senator Walker. You'll notice in the provision, in our provision, there is the name and address of the association, and the administrator is disclosed. So we just believe that the other part of it is that although common, it is by far a minority transaction that involves one of these things. And so we have to balance, again, every seller in the state is now going through all these questions. And this, we've seen various proposals. Some would double the size of the seller's disclosure over one single issue, whereas, of course, we're trying to keep it as a notice provision. So those are our concerns. But we are happy to augment that section in the form that that exists, and we'd be happy to work with anybody who had constructive ideas about disclosing information to buyers.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, as one who has bought in these associations, I can tell you that it is not uncommon for people not to know what to ask for. And when we bought, it took weeks. There was no way we could have ever met a 5 or a 7 day time frame. The seller, the house was vacant. The seller had moved to California. The president of the association was out of town. The associations are not run as businesses with regular hours. The realtor had a hard time even finding out how to contact the president of the association. These associations are not registered oftentimes. They may be a non-profit corporation. They may not. It is difficult. It is a housing concept, sir, that is not well understood by a lot of people, particularly older people who have not come up against this type of housing. Senator Walker, because she is knowledgeable, knew what to ask for. Also, I think that a lot of buyers, when they buy into a condominium, are aware, yes, this is different. This is a little bit different, and there is maybe an association here that's going to assess me so that when all the roofs need replacing, they can be replaced. But when you're buying into a single family home, you are responsible, of course, for the maintenance and upkeep, but you have these common areas, and you may have the amenities and the swimming pool and all of this that you're assessed for. And there are always things coming up. For instance, there was a lawsuit. Well, it started in 2000, 2 years after we moved there. The development had a private utility. There's tons of records at the Oregon PUC. To make a long story short, the city of Bend condemned the private utility. So we were assessed for legal fees for well over a year involving in that. Now, there again, that's something that happens after you move in, but anyone that sold their home in that development while this was going on certainly would have been obligated to have told the prospective buyer, look, we're involved with this. This is what you need to know.
Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Heitze, I've been sitting here thinking about it, and Mr. Farmer has a point, and you have a point. I don't think the seller's disclosure form needs to be burdened down with a ton of questions about that. There needs to be more disclosure, but when we bought our condominium, we put it in the contingency for our offer to purchase. We put it in as a contingency of the sale, of the purchase, that we're not going to buy this condominium until we are provided with the Homeowners Association bylaws and all the answers mm-hmm. to the questions that we have. And that, I think, is an appropriate place for those kinds of questions. And certainly when you are buying property and you know it's in a CID, your realtor is most likely going to tell you that these are the kinds of things that you want to ask and questions you want to ask. When we sold our property, my father-in-law's property, the CCNRs on there said, no dogs. Well, the CCNRs were made back in 1962, and almost every family on the street had a dog. But my point is, the form cannot be overburdened. So I still am getting back to the point where I think you two need to talk about what
I think that's
what you want.
That. Steve, do you have a comment, Steve?
I just wanted to address the committee as a real estate broker this time, having had a number of situations dealing with homeowners associations and condominium associations. In fact, we did our own form, you know, as a risk reduction and informational piece, one that I mentioned before, for these situations. This piece in the new proposed disclosure goes in concert with the earnest money agreement used predominantly around the state, mm-hmm. as Senator Walker pointed out. And it's a blank in there. You can put any number of days in there you want.
Right.
You have the time to rescind the offer if you're not happy by the number of days you put in there, plus you have the 5 days with our proposed disclosure. The other thing that I might point out is I myself, and it's certainly something I've always recommended to my clients, is you should get the information for yourself so that you know exactly what's said instead of getting information secondhand, because no matter how accurate people try to make that, it won't always be the same. And I don't think we could make a form long enough so that we could have enough information to satisfy everybody's questions in every situation. So one of the thoughts behind this was that we would stimulate the idea of getting information from the buyer, then the buyer gets to go ask all the questions they want to ask, and not depending on what the seller asks, because the seller could ask the question 3 weeks ago, and now we have a new condominium association president, and something different's happening. We've been in situations where the condominium associations met in back room, you know, the proverbial smoke-filled rooms. Nobody knew what they were doing until a year later when they came out and said, well, this is what's going to happen. So obviously in between there, somebody would have had to have checked unknown, or nobody would have been able to find out. So I think the reality of it is that people need to do their own checking in those situations so they can be completely satisfied with the information they get, especially in this situation. We've given them the contact information. We've given them some of the general parameters that seem to be the most important. They have a 5-day out with our proposed disclosure, and when they do the earnest money agreement, as Senator Walker pointed out, the professional realtor dealing with them can speak with them. If they don't have the information at hand, they can put any number of days they want in there mm-hmm. and still have the right to revoke. Thank you.
That's good. Thank you. Any further questions? Yes.
Well, just one comment, Mr. Chair, on that issue, and I have empathy with your point. You know, I've dealt with those in my own situation. This is, I think most of us have at one time or another. But the specificity does kind of get burdensome. I think one thing that maybe might be of consideration, since we have to do a few amendments here to correct some other things anyway, under the common interests, if there is a homeowners association, you know, it might be valuable then just to have a disclosure there. You know, if you're a member of an association, you may have assessments, you know, on this property. It may restrict your use or put limitations on your property, and you should, seek that information. Or something, just a general statement like that, which is, you know, like the pack of cigarettes or whatever. But it does really point out for someone that they have to look at. They have to look at that issue rather than trying to articulate what each of those might be. Again, it's caveat emptor there, but it does make it a little bit clearer. Like you say, maybe people don't know what to look for, but if they see that, they're saying, you know, they're going to ask their agent, well, what does this mean? Can we get a copy of these regulations? And I think that just would heighten it a little bit without having to go into additional questions. That's just a suggestion.
If you guys could sit down together and work something out, would that be a good thing. We've got some amendments to wait for.
Okay. I appreciate that very much.
Well, I appreciate very much your coming over and kind of keeping us on board.
Okay.
Always interesting.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, folks.
So we'll close the public hearing on 5:15 and not go into a work session, and open up a public hearing on 5:57.
Senate Bill 557 modifies seller's obligation to disclose information about real property to prospective buyer to include disclosures related to mold and health-related problems potentially related to mold. No revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. John Johnson, I don't know that. Oh, that's Scott. Okay. John Johnson. John Johnson.
Yeah.
Jim, what bills?
Yes. Mr. Chair, while Mr. Johnson's coming forward, go ahead and have a seat. I'm not going to sit out front. I just wanted to let you know that both Senate Bill 557 and 562 have been introduced by me because of the concerns that Mr. and Mrs. Johnson raised and the issues they're about ready to talk to you about. And they didn't know how the bills got broken out, and they're here to really just testify about toxic mold and disclosures, so they may dip a little bit into 562.
Okay, that's fine.
And with that, I would just like them to be able to testify.
Welcome,
Chair.
Please introduce yourself.
My name is John Johnson. This is my wife, Melissa. Gosh, this is quite the story, so we'll try and make this really compact. But 18 months ago, we purchased a house. We'd actually just sold a brand new house. It was 2 years old, and we were trying to downsize so my wife could stay home, which was 8.5 months pregnant. We bought a house, or we found a house that we wanted to buy. We put down some money, and everything was contingent upon the inspection and the disclosure. So we had a disclosure done, and then we had a termite and dry rot inspection, and everything came back clean, or, you know, a couple little things, no big deal. 3 days after that, I think it was actually the fourth day we were there, and actually she hadn't even been there yet. She was away on a retreat, and I was just moving everything from one house to the other and trying to get it kind of moved. And the first night I was there, that actually took a shower at that house, I noticed that the floor underneath, you know, in the shower was actually kind of spongy. So I was like, well, that's kind of weird. So I crawl into the house, and there's just like this big old gaping hole underneath the shower. And I'm like, well, that's not good at all. So needless to say, I'm kind of a handyman thing, and I thought, well, I'll just tear out that shower, fix that floor, and put it all back together. It'll be all good, right? Well, I started taking out the back wall and found out that in the midst of this, that there was a window that was enclosed inside this wall. And that wasn't a good thing to start off with. And then behind that, I mean, the whole thing was just all molded. Well, I'm just like, wow, okay, that's kind of just kind of tear all that apart and try and get rid of that, right? Well, it just kind of kept going. Pretty soon it was all, I looked up in the attic, and the whole attic was just black. And so, needless to say, we called a mold inspector, and or we were informed to get a mold inspector. Anyway, they came down and said it was we had some toxic mold and that it was very much not a good idea for her to be there, especially being almost 9 months pregnant. And so we were basically just told to gather our things and find some place else to live until this got resolved. Well, like I said, it was 18 months ago. It's still not resolved. And what I'm saying about this disclosure thing and all that, I think the mold thing is obviously a good thing, but I also think that most homeowners, like the other gentleman was saying, you know, they don't actually go up in their attic and they don't go into the house and they don't really know. If it wasn't in the shower, you know, they probably don't know about it. And I'm just kind of thinking that the disclosure is a great thing, and then on the other side of that is the inspector. You know, most people, when they go to buy a house, they have it inspected by, you know, a professional inspector, which is what they're paid to do.
A legal requirement by the bank as well to have an inspection done. Sorry, carry on.
Right, it's just... Anyway, so what I'm thinking, you know, and the bank only requires you to have a termite and dry rot inspection. And I think that's where the main problem is, because termite and dry rot inspectors are not required to go in the attic. They don't have to move anything out of the way to inspect anything. I mean, we had a water heater that had been leaking in that house that nobody would have known about if you didn't open the door and move the cabinet, the box that the lady had there. And then underneath the sink where they found the toxic mold, behind the wall or at the back wall of that sink, it was just black and molded. And I mean, I don't know how he missed it. I mean, we obviously never even went in there and looked in the cupboards and stuff when we, you know, people were living there when we went there. And the worst part about this is, on the morning that we went there, that we had our inspection scheduled with the inspector. I went there that morning thinking I'll just go check it out with him, you know, kind of do my own thing. And he'd already been there and gone, so it was a pretty dang quick inspection to begin with. And the disclosure, like I said, was really of no help to us, and I don't know if the mold thing on there would have really made that much difference if they were unaware of it in the first place. And they did do a bunch of work on the house themselves, and they've done a new roof, and it all looked pretty good from the outside. But, like I said, the plywood up in the attic was just rotten and delaminated, and they just basically relayered it with another sheet of plywood and re-roofed it. So, obviously, it wasn't disclosed properly, first of all. And, you know, and then second of all, the inspector, they have so many exclusions on their policies that there's actually nobody liable to this point, to this day, as far as we're still kind of homeless or house sitting.
Melissa, do you want to say something? Or?
As I interrupted him earlier,
I apologize.
basically, this has been a very frustrating road, and like my husband said, that I was a month before I had the baby. And we brought the baby here to see how she's grown. This has been a long road, a very frustrating road. We've been down. Nobody's been able to help us. We are told to leave all of our stuff there because it's frustrating. Because this mold is linked to SIDS. So would you put your child in this house that you don't know is healthy or not? So we chose to step back and let ourselves figure out what's help. So until we can figure out, we're only 5 days into the house and we're stuck with this house. It's been 18 months. We've gone to three different attorneys. They all tell us that basically we have to prove that the homeowners knew about the situation. And even prior to that, they say that it doesn't do any good to take them to court because if they have no money, you're out of luck. To get an attorney, we had to show that we had personal injury because we lived in the house, or else no attorney would take us unless we paid them $175 an hour, which we didn't have the money for. To qualify for government assistance to have attorneys would be we made too much over the line, which doesn't say a lot for us. I mean, it's not a lot of money we make, but it was very frustrating. So we were to a point where do we go on welfare to help the government help us fight this battle for us? The reason I'm telling you this is because we felt like we did nothing wrong in this, to be having this burden. And we feel like if this disclosure was filled out properly, and if maybe the mold situation, having that on there, could be maybe another avenue that we would have red flagged us, as well as the whole house inspection. This T&D, my husband, after he opened it up, this T&D, he called the termite and all right guy back, and the inspector says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I missed that. That big hole in the bottom of our in the bathroom, under the toilet."
And their thing is, the inspector is, they're not responsible for mold. I mean, they're not responsible to even find mold. I mean, if they saw it, they wouldn't say anything anyway, I think. But, like you're saying, I mean, we put $25,000 down on this house so we could lower our mortgage so she could stay home. And I don't know if the disclosure disclaimer thing, how that all actually works, but it obviously needs to be changed.
Questions?
Yes, I have a couple questions, Mr. Chair. Sure. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, did you have a whole house inspection done prior to your purchase?
No.
And
boy, do we wish we would have.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's what I'm saying. The bank only required to have a T&D, and there's a big price difference between a T&D and a whole house inspection. And at the time, we just, you know, sold our house when we were trying to buy this house, and we're like, I was like, well, let's get a T&D and see what they find. If they don't find anything, then we're probably okay. If they do, we'll get a whole house and make sure there's nothing else that we need to be worried about, right? I mean, because that's the homeowner mentality thing that they were talking about, that we don't really, you know, I mean, who would know? I think every house should have to have a full house inspection no matter what. I mean, at least they go up in the attic and they have to look a little closer around than termite and drywall inspectors do, which obviously you're going to catch a little more than you would if you never went up there. So
I guess it's It's a little bit like when you buy a car, whether you take it to a mechanic to have that whole mechanical inspection done and spend $75 or not, you kind of take a risk. But that's a pretty significant risk and a pretty significant outcome for you that that whole flooring in the bathroom was missed by the pest and dry rot inspection. I wanted to ask you, are you still making payments on the house?
Actually, we just stopped. Oh, see, we paid payments on it for, God, it's been 18 months, so it's been 10 months we paid our payments, and we just kind of were hoping to get some help and get this resolved, and obviously it never happened, so 6 months ago we just told the bank that we're going to quit making our payments, and that was the only time they ever even listened to us. Before that, they're like, well, if you do that, we're going to have to file, you know, bankruptcy on you and foreclose on your property, and we're like, well, that's not option A, but, you know, I mean, we're just going further in the hole, and like I said, we put all of our money down on this house, and then after we found out that we had a problem there, we had to have three different people come in and do termite and dry rot inspections because the attorney wanted the same kind of inspection done on all three cases, and then they also wanted three different mold inspectors to come in and do their tests to make sure they were all the same. And so, I mean, we just had a whole bunch of money, and I mean, we're just like moneyless, and like she said, we make this much more than you can get for financial aid for an attorney, and we didn't really have any extra money to hire an attorney, and so we're just stuck, and it's a mess, and we're homeless.
It's frustrating, though, because we did, it came to the point for a liability issue. The T&D has some, the inspector had so many exclusions in his contract that he wasn't liable. The homeowner, we tried to go back, look at them, and we were told you can't get blood out, or what is that saying, can't get blood out of a turnip? So here, you know, the bank lent us money, and we had excellent credit, and now our credit is just, you know, the bank.
Ending.
Now the bank doesn't want the house because what are they going to do with it? Mm-hmm. So we couldn't ask for a foreclosure now. I mean, it's a truly a nightmare story, and not to mention all of our stuff's still there. Still, we had to totally start all over. Some people argument with that, and that's been hard. You know, it can be cleaned. We don't have the money to have everything cleaned, and if it was, you know, like I said, we have a daughter, and it's a scary thought to think that that was going to sit. So we're here to say something needs to happen to protect. We know it's too late for us, but there's something that needs to happen to protect people out there.
Mr. Chair, thank you. When I've talked to you in the past, I unfortunately advised you that probably one of your last-ditch alternatives is to be filing bankruptcy, and then the bank will get their house back, and they can deal with it. But, you know, that's really an unfortunate thing that you're in that situation. But let me ask you this question. Since you've been into this issue, how many other people have you learned about who have mold in their houses and have had difficulties like this?
Quite a few. It's a small town. We're from Eugene, and it's a small town. And, I mean, I'm sure you guys have heard of Ernie Kant. And
the O'Hara's.
I mean, we've had meetings with all of them, and like the O'Hara's, we had lunch with them, and they were like, you know, just count your blessings that you got out of there with your health and that your kids are still, you know. And here's another thing, means we were talking about that disclosure deal and that part about, you know, that you were saying about has anybody had any health problems or not. Well, you know, what's really funny is after we had bought that house, the lady was like, something about her son. He was always sick. He was allergic to everything, you know. And then we buy this house and we find out it has this toxic mold. I'm thinking, well, you know, we called him and told him. I said, you know, hey, maybe you want to have him checked for some kind of a toxic mold problem if he, you know, because he was the only one in the house that had the problem. And obviously everybody has their own immunity to different things. And, I mean, I think that was obviously part of his problem was that they were in that mold situation. And, like, that part of that might be helpful in some cases. I mean, the attorney said, you know, you can't ask those kind of questions, but I don't see where it would really hurt if there is a problem like that.
Well, I appreciate you both coming up today.
Yes, thank you very much.
We're
going
to try to get something in here so we can have some more disclosure. And you're right, we can't help you now.
Right. I'm sorry.
But, no, and I appreciate that you came up. And gave us your input.
Kind of off the wall, aren't we? But, you know, that's our story.
Thank you.
It's like, very helpful.
Very
helpful.
I just hope that you guys realize this is real. And
very real.
And if you guys can help people, that would be really appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Thanks.
Mr. Taylor. Welcome again, Scott. And please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Taylor. I am the Oregon Real Estate Commissioner. Actually, I came to testify on both Senate Bill 557 and 562, and if you don't mind, I just soon combine it into this one. As commissioner, part of my duties is I belong to an organization known as the Association of Real Estate License Law Officials, commonly known as ARELO, and that's an international organization of people like me that regulate the real estate industry. Over the last year and a half or so, that organization has been working with this issue. And I thought I'd bring you some of the benefits of my experience there just to help you in this deliberation. The agency really doesn't have a position on this. I served as a chairman of a work group attempting to develop something so that the jurisdictions, at least within the United States, could have some sort of a uniform approach to this problem, because we do have licensees that work across state borders, and we are trying to keep it as simple as possible. The members of that group came from Oregon, Texas, Colorado, Louisiana, and Maryland, so you can see that we have some states that have a history with this issue. Louisiana, obviously, is a fairly wet state, as well as a group known as the Employee Relocation Council, which is a consortium of a number of third-party relocation firms that move corporate transferees. What we, and I've seen and had more seminars than I care to mention on mold and learned far more than I cared to ever know about it. What seems to be common to all of these is, in order to have the problem to any great extent beyond the shower situation, for example, is you need to have moisture, stagnant air, and a food supply for the mold, which most houses have ample food supplies for mold. But if they have moisture and stagnant air, they're going to also have a real high propensity for developing certain types of molds. It's interesting listening to some of the experts on this. They think part of the problem may be arising because our houses are more airtight than they used to be. The other thing that I've learned about that is mold allergies, even from the three types of mold that are generally thought to be toxic to humans, only affect a fairly small percentage of the human population, though generally they don't know it until they experience it. And those three strains really are certain strains out of literally thousands of different kinds of mold. The concern and the things I thought I'd mention about the two bills, this group, what we were able to come up with was we felt that sellers' disclosure statements, where they existed, ought to incorporate many of the things that Senate Bill 515 has, along with what I would say Senator Walker's bill has. I'm looking at 557 in sub G, which is the tested, treated for situation. Again, with the idea of not stigmatizing every property, because it doesn't affect every property, but pointing at the symptoms and the causes of the problem, and letting the consumer be aware what those may be and whether or not there's been any remediation done. So to the extent that that sort of a thing is in legislation, we would support that, because we think that does benefit the consumer. Sub J was the one that I had a concern with. I'm not aware of another jurisdiction that has ever proposed something like that, and at least from the agency standpoint, the concern that I would have is you may be putting real estate licensees, if they're in a situation where they may have a seller deal with something like that, where they're at cross purposes with both the state law as well as some federal legislation. If you look at the verbiage in J, I have a spinal cord injury. And at one time or another, some of those symptoms I've experienced at one time or another, many of them are chronic to me. If you look at ORS 93-275, which Matt Farmer alluded to briefly, you'll see in there that there is a prohibition for from disclosing whether or not someone has AIDS or has had HIV and resides in a property. And if you look at the federal legislation, you'll find that also. Plus, it also applies to other protected classes. And if you look at those symptoms, they could apply to AIDS. So I think I'd be very concerned and very careful if I were you. If you're dealing with people's individual symptoms, go ahead and work with the property. I think that's fine. Mm-hmm. And what you decide to do there is your purview. But when you get into these others, I think you have some concerns that you need to be very careful about. Mm-hmm. That would include or conclude what I'd have to say to answer any questions.
Questions? Well, and yes, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank Ms. Taylor. The realtors brought that to my attention and expressed that issue as well, and it's been very helpful to hear your discussion about what's going on nationally about that. And I at this point tend to agree with you, unfortunately, because you know, as the Johnsons pointed out, I'm not sure. Maybe if they'd asked that question, they might have known. I don't know, but I appreciate that, your comments.
Is there any potential, any type of federal legislation or something like that that's sitting out there?
Senator Nelson, Representative Conyers, has introduced legislation that would require active disclosure of mold problems. Again, in looking at his legislation, the problem is the person has to know it before they can disclose it, and oftentimes it's hidden within the walls or something. So I've read his legislation. I don't know that it really goes anywhere to solve the problem. It is a problem.
Thank you. That brings to mind, is there an inspector, like a TMD inspector? Is there a mold inspector that you can hire specifically to look for mold?
Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, part of the problem, if you look at this problem from a national perspective, and I think it applies to Oregon, as far as I know, there is no certification process for inspectors of mold in Oregon, and I think that's true pretty nationwide. The experts that I heard about or heard from primarily were from Texas, where they really had a lot of work on this particular issue because of the numerous lawsuits that have issued out of the Austin area, as I recall. And they're experiencing the same problems there. If you talk to one inspector, they will favor, for example, an air test. If you talk to somebody else, they'll say, yeah, an air test works, but you got to do it a number of times over a different period of time in different places. Then you talk to another one, and they say, well, the way to do it is what's known as a tape lift, which is basically you got to put a piece of tape on it, pull it up, and then you go to the lab and analyze what kind of mold it is, whether it's active, whether it's dormant, that kind of thing. So at this point, the science isn't well enough developed from what I've been able to determine even to get there yet.
That answers that question.
It does. Any further questions here? Scott, thank you very much. I don't have anybody else signed up to testify on 557, so we'll close the public hearing, and we'll open the public hearing 562, but we've taken the testimony, basically, and let the record reflect that we have discussed 562 in the context of 557. I think it's the same. Well, there are some extra people here. Does anybody want to testify against any of the testify for their for or against all this thing? We have Phil Donovan, Sean Miller, Sharon Fleming, and Anne and Marie Williams. If you guys want to come testify, we don't intend to move this bill today, but you're certainly welcome to come up and testify.
Please, we'll just rotate here, I guess.
Sorry.
public hearing. Did it open the public hearing on 516?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
And incorporated the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Oregon Rental Housing Association. Here today in opposition to Senate Bill 562. I want to address Section 1 of the bill. I know you've been dealing with Section 2 of this particular bill with disclosure and real estate disclosure on sale, and I'd like to just focus on Section 1 requiring landlords to maintain property free from significant quantities of mold. I would like to tell you, you've heard from prior testimony in what causes mold. Obviously, it's caused by a key ingredient, moisture. And living in a state that has significant quantities of rain, we're not here to debate the thousand different kinds of mold, because I know there is the toxic mold, and there's probably mold that's in every one of our homes across the state. However, I want to talk about the amendments or the proposed bill in Section 1 and what could be is under the control of the landlord and some of the problems that may be encountered with the tenants and how that differs. The bill amends Chapter 90320, which is the habitability statute in Chapter 90 in landlord-tenant law. Essentially says that what a landlord has to maintain during the tenancy as habitable. And if you look down that list in Section 1, page 1 of the bill, lines 8 and 9, it says essentially a landlord has to have effective waterproofing and weather protection of roof and exterior walls, including windows and doors. If you look down at lines 10 and 11, plumbing facilities which conform to applicable law in effect at the time of installation and maintaining in good working order. Applicable law is the state building code. Going down to lines 19 and 20, adequate heating and facilities, which is ventilation, included in that. That has to be maintained in good working order. Those are the key elements of controlling moisture that a landlord can't control, that we believe is in current law and is required by current law. When you get into what's added to the bill, essentially provided that the landlord, on commencement of the rental agreement, and then on page 2 of the bill, has to, lines or sub C, line 4, free from significant quantities of mold, obviously very difficult, and we feel could open up further litigation in an area that's still undefined. And when I talk about litigation, and I understand, you know, I really sympathize with the family that was up here dealing with the disclosure form of this, but from I know mold is an issue that that I know the trial lawyers are litigating a lot right now. There is a lot of activity. It is a national issue, and they're actually running, and I've seen seminars advertised as mold is gold. And so it is an issue that we take seriously, and I know, again, sympathize with those families who do have mold in their properties, and we are doing the best efforts we can to free of that, but significant quantities of mold, very difficult to define. I have with me Sharon Fleming Barrett, who's our legislative director, to talk about mold. She's been a property owner, property management and manager, and a landlord for several years, and just to talk real briefly about the issue today in the bill. Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Chair Sharon Fleming Barrett, legislative director, Oregon Rental Housing Association. Probably for this purpose, more importantly, I've been in property management for more than 32 years in the greater Portland metropolitan area. I've seen mold. I've seen mold in all kinds of places. A lot of the mold I've seen has been caused by tenants failing to use the systems that landlords give them correctly. One of the things that I teach our members, the first thing you can do to help with this mold issue is to immediately rewire every bathroom switch so that you don't have two choices. When you turn on one switch, the light comes on and the fan comes on, because most mold starts there. Some of the toxic mold issues that we're talking about aren't in the bathroom. Most of them are hiding in the basements and in the attics, and most tenants don't even know they exist. Most landlords don't know they exist. It takes a considerable amount of work to find some of the molds that we're discovering now. in Oregon. Most people, as you've heard before, I'm sure you know more about mold than you ever wanted to know in your lives, along with a lot of us at this point. Most molds have no impact on people. There are a few toxic strains, and to have a law that is this broad, because this law that's been introduced calls for any significant quantity of any kind of mold, goes to what we believe is too broad. It goes too far for me to be held responsible because a tenant doesn't use a fan and allows mold and mildew to grow in the bathroom that is not toxic shouldn't be included. I think that what Senator Walker is trying to achieve is already there. We have a coalition of landlord and tenant advocates in this state that have been working on landlord-tenant law issues since 1981. And when an issue arises, that's where it goes, is to that coalition where both landlord and tenant advocates can bring in expert witnesses, building codes people, inspection people, tax assessors, whoever we need to help us solve a problem. That coalition has been highly successful in solving many of the problems that you as senators and representatives have heard in previous years. That coalition is also going to work on the mold issue. There aren't easy solutions. But one of our rules in the coalition is we never make a list. And that's what started here. The danger of putting a list into the law is if you leave one thing off, now it's not covered. Right now, the way this law reads, you already have the coverage that you're seeking. Landlords are responsible at the outset of the tenancy and during the tenancy to maintain the property in a habitable condition. That already includes mold. It already includes other issues that are the concern is expressed about here. I think that by adding this list, you actually are diluting the protection that tenants already have in this state.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Nelson, Senator Walker, Senator Metzger. I'm Ann Williams. I'm representing two similar constituencies today. One is the Association of Oregon Community Development Corporations. The other is St. Vincent de Paul, who is one of the largest providers and developers of affordable housing in the state. We, both as the association and with my role at St. Vincent de Paul, support the general principles of this bill to provide tenant security and ensure decent, safe, and affordable housing. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue for us is what was alluded to in the previous testimony, that these are very widely defined parameters that lead us to a lack of definition and a lack of clarity rather than the clarity that you're seeking to provide. I think the other issue for community development corporations, and I'm sure for housing authorities as well, it's very difficult for us when we are asked on one hand by Oregon Housing and Community Services and a number of our different other partners to actively engage in the preservation of affordable housing through the purchase of expiring use properties. And these are properties that were built sometimes in the 60s, sometimes in the 70s. Frequently, there are not the kind of thorough as-built descriptions of building materials or content that we're currently providing with new construction. Therefore, when we are looking at acquiring a property and considering the kinds of tenant protections which are now being asked to provide in this bill, we may not be able to proceed with that acquisition simply because the cost of doing the due diligence to assure ourselves that there is no detectable pesticide or other contaminant that may adversely affect human health, to achieve that level of due diligence may not be possible. As has been alluded, there is one firm in the state of Oregon who does provide mold testing. We've looked at that and looked at the bill, that the kind of testing that they might provide would imply in an acquisition. When we couple that with the normal acquisition due diligence, which includes termite dry rot, full building inspection, lead and asbestos, if we're now being asked to look for lead as well as contamination of maybe inadvertently applied pesticides or inadvertently spilled hazardous chemicals, as simple as simple household some household chemicals, we now have reached a level of due diligence that we cannot afford, we simply can't afford to do. So I think what the state association is asking, I know what my agency is asking, is that there be some definition and maybe there be the possibility of the inclusion of language which simply says, to the best of our knowledge, there are no present levels that would cause harm in any of these categories that have been identified. Thank you.
Next question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to present today. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Housing Authorities. We have 22 housing authorities that are located around the state that are probably best known for administering the housing choice vouchers or the Section 8 vouchers, but less well known is the fact that we also own and operate about 15,000 units statewide. And I guess I would begin by saying that the story that we heard earlier today is compelling, and it's one that we're seeking to address. Frankly, this is a growing liability concern. We now look for it. We try to educate for it. And in some instances, you know, we work very hard to remove it. When I sent this bill out to the different members to get some comments back, I got a long story from North Bend about, as an owner of Last Resort, we took over a property, got into it, found there to be mold problems, and we're reaching a point now where basically it looks like they're just going to tear it down. So clearly this is a significant issue, and we're working proactively to address it. At the same time, it's difficult to support this legislation right now because of its overbroad nature, and I guess I have to join the chorus of concerns that have been raised by others, perhaps more eloquently than I. The term significant quantities of mold doesn't differentiate between harmful and non-harmful, internal versus external molds. The reference to formaldehyde, well, formaldehyde is used in new carpets. It's used in cabinetry. It's pretty common in construction materials. The reference to pesticides and herbicides, we have to seek to control ants and rodents, and frankly, Roundup is a pretty commonly used herbicide that's not known to cause a lot of problems, as far as I know. This legislation shifts an enormous amount of liability to a landlord and would definitely increase landlord insurance costs. Perhaps, if not that, higher administrative cost, and all that contributes to reducing our ability to provide affordable housing to low-income Oregonians. At the same time, I guess we want to suggest that we want to provide input in future legislation that's brought forward. We've heard the testimony earlier about the efforts to establish some standards to help define what we're working on here. So with that, I would conclude my comments. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Questions? Just one, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the comments today, and it's an issue that's very hard to get your hands around. As you were testifying, though, Mr. Donovan, you said that this would increase our costs and so on and so forth. I was thinking at the same time I could be really facetious and say, well, so then are you putting low-income people in housing that's substandard and full of mold and full of herbicides and pesticides, and I don't think for a minute that that's what any of you are thinking about doing. I suspect that you're all very conscientious in what you do. And I just hope that this discussion today has helped us get to the point where we do realize we need to work further on this issue, and the science obviously is not there, has not caught up with us yet either. One mold inspector for the entire state of Oregon, and they're not even certified.
Recognized.
Yeah, that's a real serious problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, you're exactly right, and we are trying to address this issue proactively, especially. You know, when you're a government entity like the housing authorities, it's incumbent upon us to provide the best housing possible. And so I wasn't surprised to see this legislation, because last year I got to sit through a 2-hour seminar on mold. And, you know, at the time I was in the back of my seat going, oh, my God, you're kidding me. But yet, let me just say this. After 2 hours, it was impressed upon all of us the need to be proactive in addressing this.
Mm-hmm.
Appreciate that very much.
Yeah, well, I think for now we're probably just going to have to settle for some disclosure in the realtor's form. And I mean, they were there. I had no idea they were prepared to go forward. And I filed my bill, and lo and behold, they've got one too. So at least everyone's thinking about it, and we'll just keep working on it.
You're aware now we've got this working group, but that's as far as residential real property under 515. And you know, your input's certainly important, and so let us know where we're at with it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No further questions. We're going to close public hearing on Senate Bill 3562, and if there's no other business, we will.
Mr. Chair, I just want to apologize that we seem to run late whenever we have my bills. I want to thank the members of my committee
for staying late.
Okay.
I'll get there.
Well, it was a public hearing. Thank you. It was very much.
You have those interesting, compelling.